We have Scott F. from Bristol, PA.
Hello, my name is Scott Fleming. I'm a recovered alcoholic. Everybody, thank you, Christian. The sobriety date that has been given me is February 13, 2002. So I haven't had a drink in just over 11 years. But I haven't wanted to drink in about 10 and a half years. That's a miracle for a guy like me. You know, I've heard recently some of my friends or speakers talk about being microphone sick. You know, I guess from speaking a lot, their ego gets in them. That hasn't been my experience. I'm humbled anytime I'm asked to come in front of a microphone in Alcoholics Anonymous, or for that matter, anytime I do any service in Alcoholics Anonymous. That's been my experience. And that being said, I want to thank the group and thank Jeff for inviting me here to share a little bit about me with you and you with me. You know those things that you hear your sponsor say or your grand sponsor in early recovery and you don't know yet what they mean? And if you stick around here long enough and you do the things that AA asks us to do and you go all in and commit to this process one day at a time for the rest of your life, you eventually will come to know. I've experienced some of that lately. I remember my grand sponsor. I think he was up here, Bob B. He sponsored my original sponsor, and I love Bob. He's still one of my heroes and mentors. And he would say that his sponsor, Stump, from Northeast Philly, used to say sobriety to him was walking in the park kicking leaves with his grandson. I have a 3-year-old nephew, and I spend every Thursday, or did until he just switched schools, with my mother and my nephew every Thursday. And it wasn't too long ago, a few weeks back, where you know I dropped them off after spending the day with my mother and him, and I'm driving home, and I just started crying. You know, and I called my brother up, like it was hard for me to even talk. You know, and I said, Will, you know, your son is beautiful. And thank you for allowing me to be a part of his life, you know. I understood that day what Stump was talking about. And you guys gave me that. You know, I can never be that guy who was able to have a relationship. My brother is the person I put down my whole life. He was a year and a half younger than me. And the way my ism came out in my life before alcohol hit it was I would put people down, try to feel better than you. I never felt like I was good enough. And my brother took that abuse the most. And I would carry that shame right into Alcoholics Anonymous. I was never the big brother. I was horrible to him. I abused him. I went way beyond the sibling rivalry thing to make myself feel better. And I did that with anybody I came across. My sister, 10 years younger than me, same thing. And that's how I compensated in life, to make myself feel better. Until alcohol found me around 13 years old and hit my lips, and I was transformed. And I would never be the same person again. From that moment on, alcohol became the most important thing in my life. I didn't drink every day because I couldn't. I was 13, 14. But I can tell you this, I thought about it every minute of every day. How am I going to get it again? When are we going to get it again? When can the older kids get it for us? I couldn't wait. And everything else in my life became like background noise. And alcohol was the most important thing from that day forward. And I experienced what I thought was a lot of fun. I realize now it was at the expense of other people. And it was a lot of selfish fun. But it was magical to me. I was able to be everything I ever wanted to be, say everything I ever wanted to say, do everything I ever wanted to do, talk to girls, hang out with the guys, feel like I fit in. In fact, I don't think I knew how disconnected I was to the universe until I drank alcohol. It allowed my spirit to come out and play in this world. And you're not taking that away from me easily. You know, my mother knew it was a problem at 17 years old. Because my family, I come from a wonderful, non-judgmental, unconditionally loving family who worked their way out of Philadelphia, the poor area, and to give their kids a middle-class, you know, life, education, and get them involved with sports, and they did that. I love my family. I never heard my mother or father say one bad word about another human being. I love them for that. And I just never fit in. I can never experience that love. Until I met you, I never had anything good that I experienced, even though it was all around me. Oh, it was all around me. My mother knew it was a problem, but you're not taking away the one thing that makes me feel comfortable in my skin, no way. But I got arrested when I was 18. I was flown down to North Carolina to play tennis in front of a coach, and I was offered a tennis scholarship. And I wanted to go to that school because I saw how they partied. It was incredible. Couldn't wait to get there. But I got arrested in my summer year before I went away to college, and I thought, you know what? I had a few charges against me. If I go into rehab, I'll get my mom, I'll appease my mother and father, and the judge will be lenient on me. So I go into rehab with no thoughts of I'm going to stop drinking. But while I'm in there, I can't help but listen to these older men, you know, 30, 40, 50 years old, talking about how they haven't seen their kids in 10, 20 years. Their parents died before they got to see them doing anything with their life. They've given up college education, careers. The shame and remorse was palpable. I could feel it. And I said, and I knew that I drank like they did, and I knew I drank, that alcohol was too important to me at 18 years old. And I said to myself, you know what, I'm not going to drink again. I'm going to go away and make my mother and father proud, to go away to school, to get a good education, play tennis, get a career. And I set off to do that. And the first day at college, my parents dropped me off and turned, you know, they drove away. I had 29 days sober. And that day, the kids on the tennis team said, Scott, you want some alcohol? We're going to get some. I said, yeah, give me a six-pack of Bud Pounders. Just like that. It reminds me of our history when Hazard's with Young, and he's there voluntarily in Switzerland, the best doctor in the world. He doesn't want to drink. He's working on letting him work on him. He leaves the next day and goes to Paris, and they asked him the same question. He wants some wine with that dinner. He said, yeah. And he went back to the doctor begging him, why did I thought you fixed me. I really thought I was going to go to school and not drink. And I put it to my lips, and my eyes watered up, and I got that feeling in my head, and I remember thinking, what was I doing not drinking for 29 days? This is the best feeling in the world. I was off to the races. I never played one match of tennis. Within a year and a half, I couldn't even go to class. I'm 19 and a half years old. Alcohol is no longer working. The cruel part of alcoholism, or the beautiful part, if you become hopeless enough to ask for help. But for me, I was becoming more confused, more alone than I had ever been in my life, even before I, even when alcohol, before I drank alcohol. And I called home, and I got out of that college campus. I thought that was the problem. And I enrolled in Bucks County Community College. I would have been the number one player there. They have a really good team. Gave that opportunity away because I'm stopping off at the bars and in the fields, drinking in the woods, 2 weeks after I'm enrolled in that school. And I never went back to that school. And I lived the next 10 years of my life meaningless and purposeless. I could tell you war stories. We all have them. I don't think that's what's important. Get locked up and all that stuff. It was meaningless and purposeless. I took my mother and father hostage in and out of their home while they looked at me like, what's wrong with our son? I abused everybody that came in my path. I had a girl that cared about me. For 8 years, she stayed with me. I didn't care about her. I couldn't care about her. I know why today. I was so self-centered. But she loved me, and I used her. And eventually, she cut me off. Thank God she did, because that helped me get into Alcoholics Anonymous. Couldn't believe she did it. But my sister's 10 years younger. When she was born, I fell in love with her. I taught her how to ride a bike, and I wanted to be the big brother. Now she's grown up in the household, and I am a monster. Alcoholism is progressing to me, and I'm bringing things into the home that I don't care to share about here and would never tell them, put their lives in danger. Abusive, verbally, physically, in my parents' home. They would ask me to leave. I would leave, and I would come back and beg them to come back, and they'd take me back, and I'd do the same thing over and over. And they could never hold a job. I would get a job, go move up quickly, then I would be let go for drinking. I could never hold an apartment. I would get an apartment. I'd have a good-paying job, and next thing I know, the lights are turned off, and the landlord's knocking on the door. Bouncing around on friends' couches, virtually homeless. The hostage finally cut me off. I had nowhere to go. I couldn't work in the end. I thought I was schizophrenic. I was hearing things and seeing things. I really thought I was schizophrenic. Now, I've been to the doctors my whole life because there was always something wrong with me. But I really thought I was schizophrenic. Please, anything but alcohol. And I'm here to tell you that I'm not schizophrenic. Not that there's anything wrong with that. I have untreated alcoholism, and there's a way up and a way out, and I didn't know that. And in the end, I wanted to die. Could not work anymore. Couldn't function. Wanted to die. And I didn't have what it took to do it. And I cried out for help in my car one day with nothing left but this little $500 car. Nowhere to live. And I said, God, please help. And that rehab came to mind. Now, that rehab had come to mind a lot in those 10 years. And I guess the pain was great enough. I made the phone call and I said, come on in. I said, how about I come in on Monday because it was Friday? And they said, no, come on in now. And I went in, thank God. And I didn't tell them the truth about how much I drank or what I did. And they gave me, because I went an outpatient. They gave me outpatient. And I was going there 4 to 9 feeling safe because I'm shot and I'm hit. I'm hurting from booze. The one problem I realized right away was they want you to make meetings. And I wasn't making meetings. There was a chalkboard. You know, during a weekend, you come back in on Monday and they say, like, Susie made 5 meetings over the weekend in a clubhouse. Joe made 2. Scott, 0. And I kept having an excuse. See, I thought I knew what Alcoholics Anonymous was all about already. I thought you guys were no fun, a bunch of old people hanging onto your chairs real tight. And if you make it through a day without a drink, you're a winner. And that didn't sound like any fun to me. And I couldn't imagine being around people like this without drinking. But I was nudged in there because I was afraid to not be a part of that outpatient group. I was afraid I would drink. So I walked into the Greater Levittown group of Alcoholics Anonymous, which Christian and I talked. We got sober at the same place. I sat on the back wall, and there was a man, Larry, speaking, who I'm friends with today. He had 12 years sober, I believe, at the time, and I listened to him while he spoke. And he sounded relatively happy, and he drank like I did. And most importantly, though, is I believed him. And I got hope. And afterwards, Tall Paul came up to me and shook my hand and said, "Do you play music? We play music in the basement." And I said, "No, I don't play music," but I was happy he shook my hand because I was the new guy there. And I remember walking out that door, going down that handicap ramp, thinking, "I can't wait to come back tomorrow." And there was a guy, Frank, coming up that ramp who was complaining about these meetings. And Frank, still to this day, can't get sober. And that wasn't my experience. I fell in love with the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous from the moment I walked in these doors, and I haven't fallen out of love with it. I fall deeper in love every single day. I went to my car, I went home, I came back the next day. It's a clubhouse, meetings, 9, noon, 5:30, 8, midnight. Like I said, I couldn't work. I was showing up to all these meetings, showing up early, staying late, listening to the speaker. I got in service right away by setting up chairs. People did that for me when I came into that group. There was coffee made, a chairperson. I hope I'm always a part of that. So I did whatever they asked. And I got involved. I became the intergroup rep 3 months sober. So because the intergroup rep drank and I was the alternate. So I'm in service at that level in Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm going to the diners afterwards talking about the wonderful things we heard in these meetings and how our lives might change. I'm branching out to other meetings. I even left our females alone. There was men. Now, I'm starting to realize that there's females in here now. I'm 11 years sober. I'm getting better. But I did. There was men in there that showed me that example. And for some reason, I knew that I was a dead man walking, and I had nothing to offer, and I better pay attention in here. And I did. And my life got so good so quick from making meetings, not drinking, being in service at that level in Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't know what your dreams are, but I have them, and I always had them. Some of them I always wanted to be a good son, a good friend, a good brother, a good student, a good guy in the community. Never could I do that. Other dreams I had was I always wanted to travel the world. I don't know what it is, but since I was a kid, I was fascinated with globes and maps, and I would just stare at them. And my mother also inspired me by saving her money. She's a teacher, and in the summers, when she didn't have school, she would travel the world late in her career and bring back all these photos and memories and sharing her experiences, and I hated my mother for that. And my brother worked hard, saved his money, backpacked across Europe, all across this country. My mother and brother even traveled together. I hated them for that. But she didn't take me. I never left Levittown. That's where I could never get off the bar stool. I was too afraid to live. Making meetings, not drinking, being in service in Alcoholics Anonymous at that level gave me all kinds of wonderful things externally real quick in here. It's unbelievable. I had a business that started to go well real quick, a few months sober in here. I'm not a dumb guy, you know. And what happened was I started to save my money and invest. And my brother at 5 months sober says, "Why don't we go to Ireland?" Now I had money in the bank. My mother and father, they're showing me off to the family. You know, they're proud. I mean, they want me to live with. I still think they want me to live with today, you know. My eyes were looking better. My skin's looking better. Their son's sober. They can't believe it. The hostage that I cut off, that cut me off, she calls me up. I couldn't get her to answer my call. She said, "I heard you're sober." I said, "Yeah, I'm sober. 3 months. I'm going to AA. I want to see." I ran to her and made that fake amends, you know, that I have to go back later and make when I got to 8. There was a meeting list for all the meetings in Ireland in a clubhouse closet. I thought that was a sign to go. So we plan this trip, and I fly to Shannon, Ireland, 6 months sober. And I got off the plane. I knew right away this was going to be hard. Second day, we're in like Galway or something. I want to drink. We were looking for the ring of curry, and I remember thinking, why can't I have a few beers with my brother? Why can't I? Third day, and I make a conscious decision, I'm going to drink before this is over. I'm going to drink. Fourth day, I'm in a restaurant / pub. That's all they have over there to eat. Now I'm making meetings, and I'm journaling, and I'm calling people from home, and I want to drink so bad it hurts. And I would have drank if it wasn't for my brother. But I had abused him my whole life, and he knew I was in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I looked at him, and I said, hey, Will, I got to get out of here. Because I had heard in a meeting, at some point in your sobriety, the only thing between you and a drink will be God. I didn't know what that meant. I didn't want to know what that was going to mean. I was about to find out. I went to our bed and breakfast. I went into the bathroom, went into the closed the door, put a towel down the crack of the door, got on my knees. For the first time in my life, I said, God, I want to drink, but I don't want to drink. Please help me. I didn't drink. But what's more is I didn't want to drink after that moment. I got off my knees. I went into the living room, and I realized something happened. See, for me, that was never my experience. As soon as alcohol hit my lips at 13, it owned me. I was a slave to it. My mouth would water in the morning. I'd answer the call. I'd have no choice in the matter. Even when I hated drinking, I despised it in my late 20s. I'd walk to the bar. I remember crying like a baby because I didn't want to go. And I'd get to the door, and I'd have to wipe them off and go in. And it was taken from me. And I even flew to Glasgow. I went to Edinburgh on my own, and I'm walking around this foreign city alone, but bar lights are flashing, which to me are the most attractive things in the world. And I don't want to go in. There's no I wish I could. There was no pool. It was taken. And I flew back to Dublin to meet him up again, and we got on the flight home. And on that flight, now I'm interested in Alcoholics Anonymous, the big book, because something happened to me. There was a guy trying to sponsor me in that 6 months, but I wasn't letting him. I was too afraid. I'm not a victim of Alcoholics Anonymous. I know I hear them. They're in here that people are trying to kill people and they didn't hear the message. I heard the message. It was one guy especially that I saw it. I heard it. I was afraid of it. And I felt like I wasn't worthy of it. So I stayed away and I chose the easier, softer way that I thought would be. And it proved to fail to me because I was 6 months physically sober, living a dream, wanting to drink worse than I ever did, making meetings. I opened a big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and the first chapter was Weak Gnostics. The first line is, my eyes see is either God's everything, he either is or isn't what your choice to be. And I knew he was. And I knew I would be okay for the rest of my life if I depended on God. And that's all I ever really wanted, was to feel okay. Alcohol came close, but it wasn't real. And this was real. And I knew it with everything in my being. And this intuitive thought came to me, or inspirational thought. I said, Scott, when you get off the plane, go see that man in your home group that when he walked in the doors, you were attracted to him, but afraid of him at the same time. And that's what I did. I went to my home group, and within about 2 weeks, I was sitting right next to him. And one day he said, do you want me to sponsor you or something? I said, John, I never thought you'd ask. It's like asking another man to be your Valentine. It is not easy. And we sat down, and my journey began. My spiritual journey began with this man because I trusted him a little bit. And I was afraid. And I was in doubt. I had no idea what this was going to be like or feel like before I did it. But I knew I was going to drink again if I didn't. And I learned more about alcoholism and what I was up against in an hour and a half or 2 hours with this man than I did going to meetings, listening, and spending 6 months in the fellowship, one-on-one. And I started to do things I didn't think were a good idea. Things that I thought were weaknesses. Like get on my knees with another man. I felt really weird about that. You know what's great about it? That nothing happened afterwards. It was great. Other than I did it. And it continues to be true in my sobriety even today. I hope I get to talk about some of that. So I get off my knees and now he says, you know, write a fourth. I'm afraid to write a fourth. Now, it doesn't look like a good idea to me. He said, what'd you do in the third step, Scott? Pray. Ask God to help you. And I did, literally. God, this is supposed to be good for me. Please give me the courage to write this fourth step. Pen didn't stop moving for 2 hours. The magic pencil, they call it. I was done by fourth. And I called him up. John, I did it. I went over this fifth step. He laughed. Reminds me of when Bill and Bob go see Bill Dotson in the hospital. He says, oh, I'm a goner. You can't help me. I just punched out a nurse. Every time I leave this hospital, I get drunk. And they laugh. They chuckle. Because they know what God will do for him if he does what they did. And I end up at a park, which I don't think is a good idea, with my sponsor to tell him this stuff and get spiritually naked in front of him and God for the first time in my life. But I did it. And he helped me see the truth about me. And we had a nice long conversation. But basically what I remember is what he showed me is I like to feel superior over people. And in reality, I'm not. Just one of. And he showed me how I was dishonest my whole life. And I could see it. I was never truthful. From the moment I was in this world, I remember exaggerating, making things up to so you would think I was somebody I wasn't, or trying to gain your approval, or so I could be better than you. And it was clear why my life was a failure, and I wanted to die at 29 years old with my family not wanting me around and virtually homeless. And I was all alone. It was clear. And on the way out the park, he said to me, "Scott, I'm a human being. I'm here if you need me, but I'm fallible. God's infallible. All-powerful, infinite knowledge and wisdom, that's the most important relationship you have. He put my dependence in its proper place. I need people, yes, I do. And I have mentors and heroes, and I hope I get to talk about that to some of those things that came in my life and I love and I have relationships with and I look up to and admire. But he said, God is the most important relationship you have in your life. He said, that's what Sam Shoemaker told Bill Wilson. Sam said, when you see the man with the problem, put his hand in the hand of him who has all the answers. Then go home, don't stick around and play God. And I went home, and I took that hour the book says to do, and I said the formal things it says to do. God, I know you better. Thank you. I know you better from the bottom of my heart. I looked over the first five proposals. I did the best I could. And in that hour, as I sat there and reflected on my life, something happened in an instant where I knew alcohol was no longer the answer for me. I felt an overwhelming presence that's ineffable. I can't describe it. But I can tell you this, that I haven't wanted to drink from that day to this day. And I think it's because alcohol and God can't coexist. And I had the real thing. It went, Alcoholics Anonymous went from my, it was no longer neck up. It was in my heart. And it hasn't left my heart. And that's why these are words you've never had to hear my sponsor say. And I hope you never do. Who are you helping? Because it's in here. And when it's in here, it wants to come out. So in that hour, here's the fifth step promises coming true in my life. I knew I was forgiven. For everything I took to my sponsor and God in that park. For everything I started to take responsibility for. I knew God forgave me and I had a clean slate. I haven't felt shame since. The shame melted away. I've been given a peace at my core from that moment to this moment that hasn't left me. Even when the storms of life would show up at 8 years sober and put me on my back. And I left that hour and I went to a meeting and I had something extra that night. I walk into the meeting and my friend Elena comes over to me, who's still sober today, and she came 3 months after me. We've always been friends, and I looked at her and something was different. For the first time in my life, I was looking at other human beings' eyes. I didn't want to leave them. I always hung my head around you. I never felt worthy. I could never look in your eyes. If I did, I was uncomfortable. I was clean. Go through the meeting on the way home. Something very important happened to me that night. I take this man, Bill, home, who was way less fortunate than me. He had no money. He was virtually homeless. I had a business. I had money. I'd buy him a lunch, take him. That was just simple, basic stuff, right? But I had nothing real in the way of our program to offer him. But now I did. Just something little. I did a fifth step. And on the way home, all I said to Bill was, "Hey, Bill, do you have a sponsor?" Because I wanted him to experience what I did earlier in the day. And he looked at me and said, "Yeah, you." And I said, "I'll take you as far as I can, Bill." And the next day, Bill and I were on our knees looking at the first three steps. And 2 weeks later, I'm in a park with Bill listening to his fifth step. And what an honor it is to listen to another man's fifth step. What an honor. And as I'm in that park with Bill, it becomes very clear about what my purpose in life is. And it has never left me. And I left that park with tears running down my cheeks because for the first time in my life, I was unconditionally in love with another human being. I would have spent as much time as it took in that park for Bill to know God's real, for him to know he's forgiven. I would have given up anything that had been given to me materially. I had been given a lot at that point for Bill to have a purpose much like I did with him in the park that day. For him to know he never has to drink again. And that's been my purpose from that day to this day. I come back to meetings not because I need to. Now, yes, I do need to stay sober. But in a vision for you, Bill and Bob talk about it. That motive becomes secondary. It's transcended by this new motive, the way I feel when I'm of use to others. I come back these doors, and I can't wait to come back to Alcoholics Anonymous every day. I wish I could be in meetings all day long. That's how much I love it. I like coming to meetings more than I used to like going to the bar or to the cake party when it was magical. That's unbelievable. But that's the truth, because this is real. I come back here to shout the good news. And I ran out and made all my amends, because I was wanting to go to any length for victory over alcohol, and the things of the world became less important than the things of the Spirit. And I made the easy ones, you know, like my mom, my ex-girlfriend, you know, the easy ones. But I had hard ones on my list that I couldn't do on my own. Bill was catching up to me, though. I had Bill on his eight-step list. And I cared enough about Bill to stay one step ahead, so I prayed for the willingness. And I prayed for the willingness to make amends to, like, my hardest one ever, my brother. And I sat down with my brother after I had been given the courage. And I cried like a baby before I even got words out. And we had a nice conversation. And my brother said, "I don't know if I could ever be as honest as you were right there, Scott." And my brother and I have started a relationship from that day to this day, and it grows. Before that, I wasn't drinking or hurting him for many months, but I had no relationship with him until I looked him in the eyes and took responsibility for that. And what happened was I would leave and drive 95 south from his home, or north, and realize I had a relationship. And what happened was he called me up a few months later and asked him to take him through the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. He's not an alcoholic. And my brother's well adjusted to life. I admire the way he lives, very fairly, very kind man. But he saw what AA did with his brother, and he wanted some. He wanted more. So I sat with him. He gave me a history lesson, because he's a history teacher. I gave him a history lesson of AA, which he loves. He knows more about the history of AA than most people do in AA. And he's still interested in and studies it. And I walked him down this path, and I listened to his fifth step right where I made that direct amends with him. And my brother didn't have many names. He's very, like I said, but there was one. He looked at some of the things that bothered him about his wife from a different angle. We could see how he's inconsiderate. But one person went to his A-step list. His ex-girlfriend, Sarah, from 12 years ago, who lived in North Jersey, he hasn't seen in 12 years. He cheated on her, and he left her, and he felt bad about that. And I said, "Will, someday you'll have to make this right." Now, I don't tell him to go find her, because he's not going to drink and die if he doesn't. He's not an alcoholic. But a few months later, I get a text message. Ran into Sarah at the Austin airport, made amends incredible. My brother's walking through the Austin airport in Texas. His flight gets delayed. He locks eyes with the one person on his A-step list, Sarah. She's with her brother. He's with his wife. They go to the bathroom at the same time. He said, "Scott, I was prepared to do what I had to do, and I made that amends, and she forgave me." He said, "It's the best experience he ever had in his life." He called my mom that night and said, "Mom, I physically felt different when I did that." My brother moved to New Zealand shortly afterwards, and I showed him how we live in 10, 11, 12, because to me, it's not about mechanics. It's not about form anymore. The numbers fall away, and it becomes a dance with God, a way of life, a way of being. And I showed him how we live in 10, 11, and 12. And he went off to New Zealand. He lives this way of life. You know how I know? I went over there to visit him. And we're sitting there, and he was telling me how he went off a little bit on his sister-in-law, and he didn't like the way he reacted to her. And he set up an amends for the following week to sit with her and make that direct amends. My brother's working this program faster than I am. It's enriching his life and those around him. And that's what, to me, this is all about. This nine-step end, this program is about me being of maximum use to God and my fellows. That's what it's all about. So I go after these amends like my grandmother. I never was a grandson, never cared to be. Couldn't do it if I wanted to. I start showing up. She's 86 years old. I just start playing cards with her, doing whatever she wants to do. She likes to go to Atlantic City. I start taking her to Atlantic City. One day I said, "Grandma, if you hit big, what would you do?" She said, "I know exactly what I would do. Got to hire a driver to take me to New England before I die to see my family and friends, but I know it'll never happen." Now, I'm in Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm working. I got a business. I started a second business. I'm investing, not wasting my money. I'm making financial amends so it comes back to you, not for that reason, but it does. And I call her up 6 months later. "Grandma, remember that trip you told me about? I want to do it with you." "What trip, Scott?" "The one where you want to go up to New England." "Oh, what are you talking about? I have no money. I'm old. You'll have no fun. I need my own room." I begged her. And she allowed me to take her. And I picked my grandmother up. We went up to New England, up to New Hampshire, where she was born and raised. And I sat with her 91-year-old sister and 91-year-old brother and her 84-year-old sister. And we had dinner. And I got to talk with them and learn so much about our family. And I got to sit with her at her 86-year-old best friend's house for half a day. Well, they laughed and told stories and cried. I got to laugh and cry with them. I took her to the field where she used to run and play, where she had her first kiss, the church she was a part of. We even went to another friend's house in Massachusetts. I mean, 8 days with my grandmother in New England. And on the way home, we had a blast. We stopped at a nudist colony in Connecticut. We drove by. I mean, I think I told her I liked this a little too much because she asked me to take her to Wisconsin the following year. You know? And we get home, and my grandmother falls ill, and a few months later, she passes away. And the whole family came up to me and would tell me how she wouldn't stop talking about that trip and how she would show them the picture album of us, that whole trip, every time they went over that house. And they asked me to eulogize her at the funeral. Now, I wasn't allowed around the family. Wasn't wanted around the family. Here I am a few years sober, and I'm given that honor. Thank you, Alcoholics Anonymous, for allowing me to be a part of my grandmother's last wish on earth. That's my favorite trip I've ever been on. We were talking about the blessings a little bit before the meeting, which have happened to me and for me. And that's okay. I mean, that's not what it's about. But I've been to 40 countries in the last 7 years. 40 countries in the last 7 years. 95% of that has been inside Alcoholics Anonymous. Whether I'm in service, whether I've been asked to speak somewhere, or whether I'm just attending a roundup or a conference somewhere in the world, or whether I have friends all over the world, which I do today, which I was alone 11 years ago, had no friends, no family. I have friends all over the world that invite me back to their homes. And I get to go to their home group, experience their AA, and I get to reciprocate, and they get to stay with me. I've had friends from Australia, from England, from Scotland, from you name it. They've been over to my home, and I get to show them our culture, and I get to take them to our restaurant, to take them to my home group. I learned how to ride a motorcycle in Vietnam with my best friend in AA. We bought motorcycles in Ho Chi Minh City after coming through Thailand and Cambodia, and we bought motorcycles. Secondhand, and we drove around across the whole country. I never drove a motorcycle before in my life. And we're making meetings over there, and we get lost, and we lose each other for a day. Scariest thing that ever happened to me. Except for when we got chased by the Russian mob in Barcelona. A bunch of my friends and I went to a convention in the coast of Spain. We went and hung out in Barcelona. Las Ramblas is crazy. And we really got chased by the Russian mob for breaking up their little shell game. Because we're from Philly. We understand how it works. So, but I learned how to scuba dive in Indonesia at the Bali convention. I learned how to ride elephants in Thailand and Laos at the Thailand convention. I learned at a year sober, I'm at the Hawaii convention on top of a volcano at 5 a.m. with 300 other alcoholics at a year sober. And as soon as the sun comes up, we break into the Lord's Prayer, all 300 of us. And I got tears coming down my cheeks because how did I get there at a year sober? I know how I get there. It had nothing to do with me. Alcoholics Anonymous and God. Way to go, Alcoholics Anonymous and God. And I get to share up top of that mountain. And I've been fortunate enough and had the opportunity to travel all around the world. I had the honor of being a godfather of my good friend in AA's baby, and he from him and me traveling, he traveled the world. I met a girl from Moldova and married her, and he had a baby, and the family lives in Portugal, and he asked me to come over for the ceremony and be a godfather. So I fly over there, but I want to see Africa while I'm there because I've always wanted to see Africa. So I fly into Madrid, I go on down into Africa, and I go to Marrakech and Fez, and I'm in the I go into the Sahara Desert for 3 days with nomads on camels, sleeping under the stars. First day in there, I come across this Moroccan man. He comes across, and we're talking, and it's very hard for me to not talk about Alcoholics Anonymous because you have given me life, and I owe you my life, and I love AA, so I always bring it up. And he says, "What is that?" And I start to tell him, and his wife looks at me and says, "Is this like a change in consciousness thing?" I said, "Yeah, it is." He looks up at me and says, "I can't stop drinking. I get sober, I stay sober 2 months, then I go back to the drink. And it's killing my wife and my newborn baby who was there. They don't have Alcoholics Anonymous in Morocco. And it becomes very clear why I'm there. See, I think I'm going there to be adventurous. And God says, I'm going to use you. And I'm sure I miss many opportunities. But when I open my eyes and I come here to serve, that's the kind of stuff that happens to me. And that kind of stuff has happened to me over and over and over again in my travels. Things that just blow my mind. And I continue on this path, and I continue to go after this like the drowning man sees a life preserver. And my life takes off because it matches. The inside matches the outside, and I have an abundant life. And around 8 years sober, you know, life shows up like they say it will. And I get rocked with about five things. I get into business with my best friend in AA. He stabs me in the back the way I see it and takes all the money. And I had to walk away from that friendship and that money, and it was a lot of money. And we were best friends. I was the best man at his wedding in Alcoholics Anonymous. I buy a house with a girl, a 2-year relationship, and I had to walk away from that house, and it was very, very hard, but I was able to hold my head high and not say one word about her. And you know what happened to me at that time? I had become I didn't have a sponsor anymore in a way. I had a sponsor who put my hand in God's hands and took me through this work, and I still am friends with him. But I knew I wanted more. And this man came into my life, this man named Vance, who I love this man. And I knew he was the man for me. And we began this relationship, thank God, right there. And he wanted me to write another four step, which I thought was crazy. He said, your ego doesn't like the number four, Scott. Write inventory. So I did. I followed direction, and him and I have had now a 2.5-year relationship where I meet with him every week for 3 hours when he's in town. Can't describe to you what that means to me, how much I love this man. Anyway, he came into my life at the right time, and I became sponsored again, taking direction again. And those two things happened. Then I opened up papers, and I was being sued in a federal court in a civil case for extraordinary amount of money that, you know, and I took the wind out of me when I saw it, and I was in that case for 1.5 years, and I didn't do anything. The guy had a resentment against me. In fact, he let me out of the case and made amends for it, but he almost destroyed my business. And those three things were nothing. You give me the ability to be single and completely happy, not need anybody in my life. I feel complete. I'm content. If somebody wants to come into my life and add to it, that's great. I'm open. But I don't need that. And I was single for a while in Alcoholics Anonymous, throwing myself more into it, if it's possible. And I end up down at San Antonio World Convention. If you haven't gone to these, go to them. I've been to two. And I'm down at San Antonio World Convention. I see friends all over the world I know. It's amazing. And I meet this girl. And I fall head over heels. Can't help it. And she's the most beautiful girl I ever saw. Her personality was incredible. She lives in California. I checked with my sponsor. She had 2.5 years sober. I had 8.5. He said, Scott, you're both newcomers. I said, all right. You know, she's doing a deal. I met her sponsor, has commitments. Everything's great. Flying back and forth, you know. And she was going to move here. And one day she calls me up and says, Scott, I got to tell you something. Crying. I don't have this time sober I said I had. You're the first person I'm telling, but I smoked a joint. And I never told a soul, and I've been lying about my time. And I mean, I wanted to fly out there and fix it, you know. And thank God I had a sponsor. And because he doesn't tell me what to do. It seems to be God's voice. He seems to know inside and pull out of me what I really know I need to do and give me the courage to do that, help me with that. I knew I needed to walk away. And so I asked her after, you know, I thought it was great for her. Right? This is your spiritual truth. This is, you know, and I knew that, but it was bittersweet, you know, because I really liked this girl. And what happened was I said to her, please don't contact me anymore, you know, for your own good. Who knows what will happen in the future. And then I had to feel the feelings of rejection when she didn't contact me, you know. And once I asked her not to do that, I flew to New Zealand again to see my brother. And I flew home, and my right-hand man in business, who had been working with me for 4 years, I think, every day, all day, gave me his 2 weeks' notice, and we threw him a big party, 150 people. And I cried on my shoulder that night, and I asked him, are you afraid? And he said, no. I didn't know what the problem was. I just said, I thought maybe he's afraid to move on, you know. And the next day, I get into my accounting system, and I stopped counting about $150,000. He probably did $250,000 worth of damage. He had basically bankrupted me in my business. I haven't seen him since. I can't tell you how dark that was. The broken heart was worse, I'll tell you that. But I had a broken heart, and I was financially devastated. And I could not imagine picking up the pieces and carrying on. Because I've had to rebuild before in business. It's not fun. And I had nothing left. I remember I couldn't move for 2 days. I was immobile. I couldn't face the computer to see all the damage that he had done. I'll tell you this. I was able to forgive him in the moment. I was able to forgive him in the moment and have compassion for him. How horrible it must be for him to have to be able to steal and then live with that. And you know what? I didn't even press charges because I knew I had a choice. Either go after that or throw my energy, whatever I had, into saving this company and caring enough about my staff and people that we affect in a positive way to do that. And you know what I had to do? Let my friends carry me. It was humbling. You know, I realized how much of a beginner I am in this process, really, when I thought I knew something. Now, I know everything because I know God's real. But when it comes to life and experience in life, I'm a baby in this. And I got to talk to my sponsor about that. And I got to cry on the phone with him and my mom. And I got to let my friends carry me. And 2 years later, 2.5 years later, that business is 60% more profitable. Now, it's a business with a higher purpose, but it still has numbers. I wouldn't have the staff I have today, which I love working with, if he didn't leave with all that money. We have grown exponentially. That girl called me up finally after a year. Wanted to make amends. And first thing on the phone, she says, "Scott, you saved my life." And I know I didn't do that. I know that we don't do that in here. We're just channels, but I don't take credit for that. But she says, "No, listen to me. You did." She says, "I wasn't going to tell anybody that. I suffered every day with that, and I was going to drink again until I met you. And then you treated me, and how you treated me so good, and how the people I saw, we have a fellowship out in Levittown and Bristol that to me is the fellowship I crave." She saw that and wanted that, and she said, "You gave me the courage to get honest." That girl today is 3.5 years sober. I got a chance to go back in that relationship and realize that it wasn't for me. So I have no questions about that. But it's for me, you've given me the ability to realize what it is to be a man. That's what else I learned about in the fifth step, is that I had it all wrong, what it is to be a man. And my sponsor and grandfather always talk about being a man of honor and dignity. I got to go into relationships and be honest. There's certain things that I can't do anymore. Yeah, I continue to grow and shed selfishness, but there's certain things that after my fifth step, with that realization, I can't do anymore. And I don't want to drink. And you know what happened for me when I had that broken heart and I had that financial devastation, a man came into my life who had been in and out of AA for years. Some of you know him in here. And I remember thinking after a while working with him and him getting sober and him coming to life and all kinds of things happened. He got a driver's license he never had. He was like almost 30 years old. He had got teeth he never had. I mean, all these things were happening for him. I remember thinking he needed me, right? Because that's why I didn't go fix it with that girl and I was financially devastated because I had full time to give him. Then I realized I needed him. Amazing. Amazing. You know, I was my sister, you know, who I had been a monster to in that household, I went to make amends to her. I was I was about to do that, say that, the direct amends, and she said, "Scott, I got to talk to you about something. I'm gay." And I got to hug my sister and tell her I love her. And she said she told me first because she felt safe with me. And that was her day. I didn't make that amends that day. I just walked with my sister and we talked. My father, I got to repay him for all the tools I stole that were his and made him take the thousands of dollars. I made him take it, even though he said, "I don't need it. I don't want it." I said, "Dad, you have to. This is your money." And I made him take that, you know. And everything's right with my family. That girl who I hostage for 8 years, she came back into my life and I made that real amends. You know what? I gave her employment when she was out of work for 2 years. She worked in my office every day. And then she got another job with her career. And so I got to make that right. We became such good friends in her working with me every day. So my whole life has been, because of Alcoholics Anonymous and God has been made right. I can't think of an amends I have. Although that guy that I don't have much time, but that guy that I ripped me off in business, you know what happened? I had a year and a half resentment in here with him. And there was times that I was doing everything the book says to do, saying the prayer, how can I be helpful? And I knew if he called me, I'd help him. But you know that thing that you want it to go away and it just isn't away yet? But I don't give up on the prayer. I don't give up on the discipline. And after a year and a half, this man, this new sponsor, I got to see why I owe him an amends. And I said I'd never make amends to him. And I got to go into his office, and I got to look him in the eyes and say, "I was wrong. Because I judged you for a year and a half, and I secretly wanted you to fail." I would have loved to have news that in that business that I had to walk away from, that I found out that he had failed and lost everything. And that's not my job, and I can't carry that. And I looked him in the eyes, and he said, "Someday, Scott, maybe greed got the best of me." He said, "Maybe someday I'll inventory and I'll come and sit with you." And I don't even care if he does. But I can tell you this, we have a better friendship today than we've ever had. He calls me up for advice in business, and I give it to him freely. He just went through where his daughter was born so prematurely, she almost didn't make it, and I got to be there for him. And I want him to succeed today. And you know what else happened out of that? Once I made that amends, once I did what I had to do, once I could see it, I learned a lesson and I could see it because I didn't give up on it. You know what happened? I ended up in Lima, Peru because I was speaking in Costa Rica on the 12th step at a convention, which I was honored to do. And I thought I always wanted to go to see Machu Picchu. So I go to Peru and see Machu Picchu. And I end up in a meeting in Lima, Spanish-speaking meeting. I don't speak Spanish. And I'm there with my friend, Barrett, from San Diego, and who I've got to travel the world with. And I'm sitting there in this meeting, and there's a guy that was, you know, translating English, what we were saying, to Spanish. And it was an incredible meeting. And afterwards, the translator came up to us and said, I want to talk to you guys after the meeting, because we just had such joy for Alcoholics Anonymous. And we said, sure. And we had plans. He said, can you come have dinner with me? We said, sure. We go and have dinner with him. And we said, what's up? What do you want to talk about? Because he had something specific. He said, now we didn't even talk about this in the meeting, but he said, I have a resentment that I can't get rid of. And now Barrett starts spitting out the one-liners. You know, that's like drinking poison and hoping the other person. But I have experience with this. So I said, well, all right, tell me what it is. And he said, I got into a business with my best friend a year and a half ago. He took all the money and all the clients. I cannot stay sober, and I hate him. I can't get rid of this. I sit back, and I start to tell him my experience. And I got to show him how his friend was suffering from fear, and that's why he's greedy, maybe. He said, oh, okay, I see it. Then we got to inventory him, and he got to see where he was dishonest from the very beginning. And he looked up in the sky, and under his glasses came tears, and he said, I see it, I see it. And I think that man is a little more free today. And that's been my experience in Alcoholics Anonymous over and over again, that I go through hard times. And I got to tell you, I value the storms of life that I've been through, the hard times, the times where I was in a fetal position, in sobriety, more than I value traveling the world. I was with my mother and sister. I finally got to travel with my mother to England at a convention, and I got to sit with Clancy and four other people in a backyard and learn and listen to the history of AA for 5 hours, which I love people that love AA. I have a lot of heroes in Alcoholics Anonymous and mentors that I sit with and listen to when I'm in their presence. And my mother and I, she was with me, and we end up in Iceland, and we're snowmobiling on top of a glacier in Iceland, you know, traveling the world. I mean, all that stuff is amazing stuff, but I value more the hard times, because they, through the alchemy of God, He uses that stuff for me. Because I can't tell you how many times I sit in my office from 2 years to now, when a guy has a broken heart, I now know how he feels. And I can talk to him about that. When a guy's been ripped off, I know how that feels. When he's been stabbed in the back, I know how that feels, and I know how to get on the other side of that. Because Alcoholics Anonymous and God are real, and you've showed me that. So you've given me something that I love to serve. I've never left the center of Alcoholics Anonymous since I came here. Nor do I want to. I hang out with people that are in the center of AA. I've never fallen out of love with AA. You've given me the knowledge and experience that God is real and that He loves me and forgives me and wants the best for me. Even when I don't feel connected to Him, I know that. That's what You've given me. That freedom, that peace, that's what it is, the peace. So I hope that I never forget what Bill Wilson writes in a long form of the 12th tradition. The last line, he writes this to the end, that our great blessings never spoil us, that we never forget, that we always keep in contemplation, in thankful contemplation, of Him who presides over us all. I love Alcoholics Anonymous. Thank you.
Okay. Wow. The group would like to thank Scott for sharing his experience, strength, and hope with us tonight. And at this time, I'm going to ask Rich to come up. And he's going to do a brief history of our group.
What happened? No rabbit. My name's Rich. I'm an alcoholic. Grateful to be alive and sober and here with you people this evening. Scott, thanks, man. Right on the head again, as always. This has been rather... I'm just going to try to give a brief history of the group. And it was rather difficult gathering information, to say the absolute least. But anyway, I'd like to say that... The original members, if you will. There was this crazy dude that was from Boston. And he came to Pennsylvania and met a man out in New York and got a good idea as to what this program is about. And his butt got set on fire. And he moved to Bucks County here and met a dude that lived down in Sellersville. And they went through the work together. And correct me after I'm done with all this, if anybody's got the information that I might have, cock eyed. But anyway, Greg H. and Chris M., I met in Quakertown in April or so of 05, and we were attending a meeting there on Monday nights, and it was a beginner's group, if you will, and it was just a bunch of drunks, you know, trying to stay sober, and a couple of them were a little bit unruly, and eventually, as time went on, Greg and Chris and this dude Sean, there was a bunch of people involved, but they primarily decided to start a meeting. It was not formed out of resentment in a coffee pot. There was a little bit of a conflict with this one member in particular that we really didn't like being around much. And so they decided that we start a meeting, a speakers group, modeled after the Harbor City group in Maryland, who Steve sponsored, Tom F., was a member of, and perhaps a founding member. And we got a church, and we started a meeting. It started on the 27th of March, 2006, at Jerusalem Lutheran Church down in Sellersville. And I kind of modeled some of my notes after a group history type thing that's supposed to go to archives. So that's what I broke it down. So some of the original early members were obviously Greg and Chris, this dude Sean, Big Dave B, Jack D, Scott P, Garen B, Jacqueline, Ricky and Jay, and Troy. Oops, sorry. Zoe, and there was countless others that I just did not remember all these names myself. And what we wanted to do was bring speakers in from not necessarily the local area. Kind of wanted to bring a venue that would bring in outside speakers delivering a consistent message of hope through God dependency and service to others. I think Dr. Bob wrote it in the back of his story in the big book about trust God. Come on, help me here. Help others, yeah, and clean house. All that. That good stuff. But anyway, so that's how it started. And, you know, I don't know. There's conflicting opinions as to how many people came to the first meetings. It started out with like 20 and then went to 40, and it grew rather quickly. Rather quickly. And there were some other groups that kind of spun off of it later on. Coming Home Group up in Allentown. Yay. Into Action Group in Spinnerstown. Blah, 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 blah. Has the group changed its name over the years? No. Has membership grown? Yes, dramatically. We eventually had a move in May of 07 to this church for insurance reasons, maybe. I don't know. There was too many people in their little room or whatever. But it was a blessing in disguise because we ended up with a pavilion in the back, and we will probably be outside first Monday in May for those that are interested. That's about it. I mean, since that time, in the beginning, like, these guys were called the God Squad. And, I don't know, like, when I got sober, man, I don't know what was so novel about the God idea, but that's what some people call it. We met a lot of opposition because we were doing microwave AA, and like these people couldn't understand the concept of newcomers being a making a contribution to Alcoholics Anonymous and society itself. These are some of Greg's words. I got him on the phone actually for an extended period of time not too long ago, and the name Feet First came from the chapter we agnostics, primarily in that we got to move our feet. We have to take action to get to stay sober, you know. And I didn't understand what any of this stuff meant. You know, Greg said to me one night, I come to a couple of meetings, and he said, you know, what are you doing Monday nights? I said, well, I've been trying to help that other group. He goes, you're not helping nothing. He said, I want you to come to feed first. And I said, why? He goes, because we need you there. I didn't know what that meant then, but I know what it means now, looking at this crowd here tonight. But anyway, you know, understanding comes after action. These are Greg's words. And we must set aside and move the feet rather than the mind, because the mind will eventually catch up if we take the actions. I found that to be true in my life. So, anyway, that's pretty much what happened. And we know what it's like now. And I hope the group continues to grow as it has. And that's about it. Thanks for letting me share that.